Well, as we wrap up this study on the Centurion, it's a real delight to have in the studio with me today, Doug Bookman. Doug went to Bible College in Minnesota at Pillsbury and then on to Central Seminary, eventually earning his PhD from Dallas Seminary in Bible Exposition. And Doug and I have had the privilege of working together now at Shepherd Seminary for a couple of years. Doug is the professor of New Testament Exposition. Right now, Doug's work entitled The Week is being prepared to be produced by Crest Publishers. This is a work that will detail in its study the final week of Christ's ministry on earth, known as the Passion Week. Doug, it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much.
And why don't we just pick it up here? We've taken this study over two parts. And when we began in our session yesterday, we talked about one of the things that would have struck this centurion, had he in fact indeed been able to have heard this, and more than likely he was there. He heard Pilate declare Jesus Christ as innocent. And I want you to tell us why that's important, as Luke's gospel, you know, has Pilate saying to the mob, "I find no guilt in him." How significant is that?
Well, it can't be overstated, its significance. And the primary reason it's so desperately significant is because, in fact, Jesus went to the cross as an unblemished lamb, as the sinless Lamb of God. And there are many cross currents here, because the fact is that early on in Jesus' public ministry, he angered the official Jewish leadership, but he also delighted the masses. And because of that, the hands of his enemies were tied, because he was so wildly popular that they couldn't simply do to him what they later did to Stephen. And that is just speared him off and stoned him to death, because had they done that, there would have been a riot, because he was so wildly popular. He was the folk hero of the masses. And therefore, the only way they could be rid of him was to get the Roman authorities to put him to death. But the only charge that they could imagine, which they could use against him, was that he was a seditionist. And this was the huge plot. There was a plot laid late on Tuesday evening to get Jesus crucified. And it's interesting that the reason this is happening with the really inappropriate speed it's happening, that is the trial and so on, that culminates in the crucifixion, is because he was so wildly popular. I always say that both the Jewish authorities and the Roman authorities have Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday ringing in their ears. On Sunday, he rides in, the whole city welcomes him as king, and then on Monday, he cleanses and possesses the temple and delights the crowds. So if they're going to be rid of him, they have to persuade the Roman authorities that he's a seditionist. And this huge plot is in place, and Jesus is arrested immediately after the Passover supper, after the experience in Gethsemane and so on. And then you have this nocturnal hearing where the Jews convene the Sanhedrinists in the attempt to come up with a charge.
And my understanding is that was an illegal trial. Oh, the Sanhedrin was not allowed to meet then.
No, embarrassingly so. The first canon of Jewish jurisprudence, according to the Old Testament, that was given by God, is that only in the mouth of two or three witnesses can any legal matter be established. And the fact is that this is a culture where when the sun goes down, you go down. And so you couldn't have a trial between sundown and sunup, specifically because you couldn't have witnesses. And all of that was violated, but it was because they were so desperate to get him tried and on his way to the cross before the city woke up. They fully anticipated the city would riot in his behalf. Now, there are some other spiritual dynamics there, but all that to say that the charge that they had come up with is that he was a seditionist. And on the face of it, it seems to be a credible charge, because he did claim to be the king. But on the other hand, he had been so circumspect, so wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove, Matthew 10:16, that they really were hard-pressed to find anybody who could testify that he claimed to be Messiah. And on that night, when the high priest, after much frustration, finally said, "Tell us, are you the Christ, the Son of the living God?" And Jesus had replied by saying, "I am." I think they were aghast and delighted. They thought, "We've got him." So now they bring him to Pilate in the early morning hours. But the important thing to say here is that five different times, actually, now there, one of them may be parallel, but at least four, and as many as five different times in the narrative, when you put the Gospels together, the duly appointed, fully authorized judge who is to give the verdict pronounces this man guiltless.
Which is Pilate.
This Pilate. And he says again and again, I find no fault in this man. And the last time he does that is in John 19 after he has interviewed Jesus for the second time in the Praetorium, and he comes out and says, I find no fault in this man. And the Jews in John 19, I believe it's verse 6, they say, well, if you're not going to put him to death as a seditionist, then we have a law and he ought to die because he claims to be the Son of God. It's unspeakably important just in terms of his sinlessness that we acknowledge that he had been vindicated as totally innocent of the charge of sedition. It's also important to understand that the reason Jesus went to the cross is because he claimed to be the Son of God. That is the explicit testimony of his accusers. Then if you won't kill him as a seditionist, he ought to die because he claims to be the Son of God, which would be, in fact, blasphemy worthy of execution if it weren't the case. It just happened to be the case, of course. So it's so important to recognize that Jesus did not die as a seditionist. There are actually three lines of evidence in that regard. The first is the five times, four or five times, that Pilate pronounces him guiltless of that charge, exonerates him, exculpates him entirely. The second line of evidence is the titulus, as it's called, the sign. And it is not without significance that Pilate, and it's interesting to try and reconstruct what's going on in Pilate's heart and head here, but his reaction is so instructive because he writes Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, in those three different languages. And again, Jesus' accusers come and they say, no, right, he claimed to be. In other words, he's a seditionist. And he said, I'm not going to write that. What I've written, I've written. So again, he publicly exonerates him. Yeah. And as Jesus goes to the cross, as he hangs on the cross, the official charge that hangs over his head is he's King of the Jews and he's been rejected.
That's amazing.
And then the third thing is, the third line of evidence is the simple fact that his body was given to Joseph and Nicodemus. Yeah. You wouldn't do that with an accused, with a convicted seditionist. His body would be left to the dogs in an open...
Maybe burning in the valley there outside
and so on,
the city.
Because so much... This is another dynamic, real quickly, that crucifixion in the Roman world was about putting down sedition. And they found ways to punctuate the point. And the fact that the body was to be defiled and left to be burned and destroyed and so on was their way of putting an exclamation point on the fact, the Roman way of putting an exclamation point on their declaration, this sedition is over. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he released the body is clear, compelling evidence.
Now, let me ask you this, Doug. Do you think Pilate was a believer? He was so conflicted, wasn't he? He was in agony.
He's one of the most fascinating and much misunderstood, and for reasons that we won't go into, but really kind of the record is a bit distorted sometime with regard to Pilate. Pilate, number one, he was clearly impacted by his interaction with this Nazarene.
Yeah.
And Paul, in a fascinating passage, just allusion, just almost a throwaway. Well, it's not a throwaway line, but in Paul in 1 Timothy 6 says to Timothy, I adjure thee by the living God and by the good confession that Jesus witnessed before Pontius Pilate. Yeah. Huh. And evidently the early church remembered and found instruction and encouragement in the way Jesus handled himself. And it's interesting that there are really in the entire public trial, Jesus only says one sentence, and that is, I am he, when he's asked, are you the one that's accused?
Yeah.
But there are these two remarkable times in John 18 and John 19, only in John, where Pilate goes into the Praetorium. The Sanhedrinist had induced him, and I'm sure there were some drachma that changed hands here, you know what I mean, but they had induced Pilate to bring the whole apparatus, the whole legal apparatus out onto the Gabbatha, the pavement, you remember, so that they wouldn't have to go in and defile themselves in a Gentile household. So here you are about 4:30 in the morning by my calculation, and you have this whole legal apparatus set up and so on, and on two different occasions, Pilate takes Jesus alone into his household and interviews him. And those are two of the most magisterial moments. And I think that's what Paul has in mind when he says, Timothy, learn from this, live like this. I adjure thee by the testimony. So clearly, Pilate was hugely impacted. He made heroic, all be it brutal attempts. Mm-hmm. Many of what went on, the Barabbas thing, he tried to release Jesus. He desperately did not want to. And I think it was primarily, perhaps, I mean, I'll give him this, that just as a Roman official, he knew the man was innocent. The Bible says that he knew it was out of envy that he'd been turned over to him and so on. Yeah. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think he was powerfully impacted and did everything he could. And there is an ancient tradition that Pilate became a believer. There are a lot of traditions that are totally undependable. But, I think very possibly we'll encounter him.
Isn't that something? Wouldn't it be great? Mm-hmm. And so here's the centurion standing by. He's watching his leader, his political leader, his chief, so to speak, commander-in-chief. And here's him, I guess one of the last things he would have done is washed his hands. Pilate washed his hands. I'm innocent of the blood of this man. And now the centurion has to take Christ to the hill. And he sees this. He's probably already softened up, so to speak, by the Lord. And then he's going to see some other things take place. He may have heard Jesus along the way remark to these women, "Don't weep for me, weep for Jerusalem." And then get to the hill, and Jesus refuses the wine mixed with gall. That was the narcotic, which would soften the pain. And he hears Christ, of course, promise paradise to this criminal. All of this. Here's a man that we can overlook that's remarkably moved and ultimately led to faith.
Absolutely. And I tell you, I mean, as we put the drama together, as it's recorded for us in the four Gospels, from the standpoint of faith, it's obviously the most perhaps compelling and meaningful and unspeakably dramatic and significant narrative in all of human history. But that scene there on the cross. But just imagine this one who has been involuntarily made a very central part of the drama. Yeah. And he, in point of fact, he knows that Jesus is innocent. Mm. And, you know, there's a bit of confusion that arises because when Judas leads the soldiers and the Sanhedrinists out to the Garden of Gethsemane in the middle of the night to arrest Jesus, he says, "The one whom I kiss." And out of that has arisen the notion that Judas was basically hired by the Sanhedrinists to identify Jesus. Well, as if they wanted to arrest him, but they couldn't pick him out of a lineup. Well, there was no set of human features more familiar in that world than Jesus. But I think that Judas' instruction, "The one whom I kiss," is for the soldiers, because the soldiers they were probably mercenaries. They had contempt for the locals, and they lived onto themselves there in their kind of palatial fortress, which was the Antonia to the north of the temple. But even given that, my point is that for 3.5 years, Jesus had been going up and down the countryside and healing all that came to him. And I just can't imagine. I always think of this with Pilate. Pilate could not have been ignorant of this Nazarene. He certainly had heard reports. I can't imagine that there was anybody who didn't know somebody who had been physically touched by this man. So you got to factor that in. Here you have this centurion. They were sort of a superstitious people anyway. I don't know to what degree this really impacts it, but I always think that as difficult as the notion was for the Jewish thinker that God could become man, it was quite familiar to the Romans. Yeah. You know, I mean, they were deifying their emperors all the time. So my point being that here he hears about this one who claims to be God, and he's going around doing all these miracles. He must have some hint of it. Now he finds himself in charge of the detail to oversee the trial and the execution. And, you know, all of those things you mentioned, there's a point of contrast here that I think is worthy of note and certainly would have been noticed by this centurion. And that is that early on he refuses that narcotic. And then yet John 19, just after he had cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And that, by the way, as you recall, is at the end of the 3 hours. For 3 hours of darkness he was silent. And enduring this judicial disfellowshipping by the Father that we can only begin to imagine. I think we'll explore that for eternity and never really understand in all of its dimensions what it meant for the Father to forsake, to turn his back upon because his Son had been made sin for us. But now after that, after those 3 hours of darkness, Jesus cries out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Giving us, I believe, the most important insight into the economy of the cross, what's actually going on there to the degree that we can comprehend it. But then Jesus does ask for a drink. And having turned down the narcotic, and I think probably what had happened is that because of the demands of the cross, we know a lot about crucifixion. It's not a pretty picture, needless to say.
Right.
But certainly it would have sapped your body of every drop of moisture.
Yeah.
And Jesus' mouth must have been swollen, his throat swollen shut, and he could hardly. What a scene it must have been as that centurion stood at the foot of the cross. And I think probably what happened is that having cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Jesus had something else to say. He desperately wanted to say it. He had paid an infinite price in order to earn the right to say it. All creation was listening to hear him say it, but he didn't have the strength to say it. And so I think probably he just in a whisper croaked, I thirst. And maybe it was that centurion. It says he went and fetched a sponge and soaked it. And just the scene as Jesus takes that cheap wine and moistens his mouth and gathers what strength he has and then cries out in victory, it is finished.
Yeah.
All of that must have, how could you walk away from that? And then to look to the Father and say, into thy hands.
Amen. Sacred ground.
Yeah,
and, like you're saying, it's going to take eternity to explore the depths of that. Let's talk about the crucifixion a little bit. We've romanticized it, and I appreciate what you're saying because you're bringing us some of the reality of the humanity of Christ, which was in pain, his body, physically. Our world focuses on that. We know spiritually and biblically that that's the lesser part of the problem.
Oh, absolutely.
And we don't want to feel sorry for Christ. He's actually fulfilling with joy what was set before him because of what he knew was ahead in the victory. But at the same time, we don't want to ignore it. We don't want to say, well, you know, he got crucified in that trouble. And I think we ought to just sort of explore that a little bit, Doug, because the church has, it has this 12-foot tall T, you know, upon which someone was softly, impaled.
Yes.
And in overtime, the person died. It's not exactly the truth. Let's describe it for our friends who are listening.
Well, I tell you what, too. You pick up on something that's so important because on the one hand, I think it's absolutely imperative that we be honest with what the cross was like. There has never been a more hideous means of execution than the cross.
Right.
I tell people on occasion, I say, imagine what it would be like if you meet a young woman and you haven't known her before and you're just talking with her and you notice that she has a necklace on and as you see that necklace and all of a sudden you realize it's a guillotine or a guillotine, however we're supposed to say that. And you think, well, that's macabre, you know, that she wants to decorate her. And, but the difference between the guillotine and the cross is that the guillotine was designed, and my French is not very good, but, you know, was designed by Dr. Guillotine to be merciful. The cross with which we decorate ourselves, it's a remarkable thing, was designed to be hideously cruel. Now, one of the dynamics of the gospel narrative, which is absolutely inescapable and so important to us, is that as you trace Jesus' life, as he draws near the cross fills him with terror. He is horrified, cripplingly so. So much so that in Gethsemane, he contemplates what he's going to endure on our behalf. Angels. There are only two times in Jesus' ministry when God the Father dispatches angels. And one is at the temptation by reason of a 40-day fast, but the other is in Gethsemane by reason of the contemplation of what about to happen. And it's a hideous. But having said that, the important thing to realize is it's not the physical suffering of the cross that fills Jesus with terror. It's being forsaken by the Father. And, you know, there is that about God, and we ought to be happy with this, which we can't fully understand.
Right.
And he reveals himself as three persons in one God, this Trinitarian reality that Christians have bowed the knee to in spite of the fact that there's no analogy to it all through Christian history. But what it teaches us most dramatically is that there is relationship intrinsic to God's character. It is quintessential to God to exist in blessed relationship. And so now you have this eternal, blessed, ineffable, ultimately inscrutable relationship between father and son that in some judicial real sense is severed.
Yeah.
And I always tell people, think about your own life. What's been the most painful, losing a job or losing a loved one? Mm. There's no place at which our souls are more vulnerable than relationship. And here you have this eternal, blessed, infinite, perfect relationship, which it's unspeakable. And that's what filled Jesus with terror. Now, with regard to the crucifixion itself, I like to tell people that there are four demands that Rome made of crucifixion. That is, they clearly took a means of execution which had been used by the Persians before them. They fine-tuned it. They refined it.
The Romans perfected
it. They perfected it with the intent of putting down sedition. The Romans had this huge, expansive empire, and there was sedition in this corner and that again and again, and they came up with very creative means of retarding that impulse in the human heart, and one of them was crucifixion. It wasn't about killing the seditionist. It was about putting down the sedition. And so they wanted it to be horribly cruel. And that's why even the scourging was primarily designed to open up lacerations on the back. He was going to be crucified, hung from a rough timber. And in order to breathe, he was going to have to hoist himself up. And they would oftentimes provide the saddle, because that's the second thing they wanted, is lingering. But my point is that as you just groaned and contorted there and across those, you had those open lacerations, and you were going to, the splinters were going to be driven into that, and you're going to cry out in hideous pain. The Romans wanted that. This is a display. And they wanted it to be cruel. They wanted it to be lingering. They wanted it to be public. That's why it was always on a small hill outside a busy gate, because a gate is a bottleneck. You can't go around. And here's this hideous scene just a little ways away, and this man, and of course, not to make merchandise of people, but the fact is that he was just far enough off the ground that with time the dogs would begin to nibble at his heels and the birds at his eyes and so on, if he were allowed to linger.
And that's right. And you mentioned, by the way, Doug, the saddle, the sedulum. Most people don't understand. There's a block of wood in that stipe, that vertical piece, which is permanent. They actually carried the cross beam up. The hill would be nailed. They'd be stood up. That'd be hoisted over the stipe and a mortise and tenon joint. It'd be a hole in the middle of that cross beam, slipped over that. Then they'd be sat on this saddle, this block of wood that's extending out horizontally. And then their feet, most often their ankles, actually, nailed into this into the stipe, the vertical piece. And you're right, they're low enough. They're only 6 feet. The cross would be 6 feet high. That means their feet are just above ground level. And many of them would die from wild animals overnight, and birds, and insanity. They would be driven insane. And so he's not so way high and lifted up with a little blood trickle. This was hideous and grotesque. And as you've said, it was designed to be torture, not just death.
The other demand that the Romans made of it that is so huge is it had to be publicly certifiable. That is, he had to die on the cross, and there had to be public demonstration of his physical death on the cross, because I go back to it. The whole design here was to put down sedition, and the Romans didn't want the rumor to get out that somehow he survived and was able to, so we could go on with the sedition. And so it's interesting that three different times in the book of John, John 3 and then John 8 and then John 12, there is reference to Jesus being lifted up. As Moses was lifted up, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. I, if I am lifted up, will draw him into myself. When I am lifted up, that's John 12, John 8 is, when I am lifted up, then you'll know that the things that I speak. And in John 18, when Jesus is taken to Pilate and the Jews tell Pilate, you got to put him to death because we can't put him to death. John insinuates the comment, this was done in fulfillment of what Jesus had said concerning the type of death he would die. It was imperative that he die by being lifted up in crucifixion. Yeah. And I think the reason is because there can be no doubt. I'm convinced that you just have to ignore everything there is to know about Roman protocols to think that Jesus somehow came alive off the cross and the coolness of the tomb revived him and so on.
That swooned.
It takes
A lot of faith.
Oh, it takes such a deliberate
against the
denial
record
of the truth.
Exactly.
Yeah. But so Jesus died a publicly certifiable death, and I think the reason it was so imperative that he die that way is because if he truly died on the cross, then during those 40 days when he returned to the very places where he had spent most of the time during his mortal life and showed himself alive, proved himself alive by many infallible proofs, the force of the resurrection is dependent upon the genuineness of his death.
Yeah,
and
point.
He genuinely, undeniably, if you weren't there, if you, you didn't have to have been there to see the blood, what you knew, that is the blood and water evacuated from when the spirit thrust right. into his side, what you knew is this is Rome.
Right.
And if you're crucified by Rome, you're not coming off that cross until you're dead.
And if there's any question that you're dead, they'll break your legs.
That's right.
And push, they would take the victim, break his leg or legs, and push him off the saddle.
That's right.
And then he wouldn't be able to push himself
wouldn't
up
be able to breathe.
To exhale.
And most of the men, the pattern was to die by asphyxiation.
Right.
Because you had to hoist yourself up once you were thrust off that saddle. The other thing to be said is that, like I say, the genuineness of the resurrection is a function of the genuineness of the death. And what Paul says is, in Romans 1:4, that he was declared, and I love the word he uses there. It means horizon. You know, the message was spread across the horizon in such a way nobody can miss it. He was declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. The resurrection was, the way God vindicates those who claim to be divine messengers is by miracle. The greatest miracle of all time was Jesus showing himself alive for 40 days.
Well, all so true, so wonderful to our faith and our hearts, Doug. Thank you. And let me tell you, our students love to sit under the ministry of Dr. Bookman as he teaches New Testament. If you'd like some information on Shepherd Seminary, contact us and we'll put that in your hands and give you an opportunity to take a look at what we're doing here at the seminary, which I have the privilege of being the president of and working with men like Doug. We've explored the truth of the crucifixion, and really we've only touched it, haven't we, Doug? We just barely pulled back the
bottom to it.
Oh, yeah, no bottom to it. But what a privilege it is. And we'll continue on as we look forward to the return of Christ and learn for eternity the glorious gospel and this cross, which Paul said, God forbid should I glory in anything other than the cross of Jesus Christ. So we do that for his glory today.